This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC. That was music by Benjamin Britten, part of a song cycle called Les Illuminations, to poetry by Rimbaud. It will be included in a program of 20th century music to be performed at the school in Kinderhook this Sunday afternoon. And my guest this month is the founder, artistic director, and conductor for Concerts in the Village, David Smith. This is Richard Roth with The Passage on WGXC, and I am here in Kinderhook with David Smith, the impresario behind the Concerts in the Village.
Delighted to be here today. Thanks for coming.
And am I correct in calling you an impresario?
Sometimes I'm an impresario. Sometimes I'm the person who gets into every detail of our venture here, which is going so well. I can be the Senior Vice President for Development. I'm the Artistic Director, most joyfully, and conductor, keyboard player, you name it, I'm involved with it.
And how long have you been doing this?
Well, it really developed beginning in 2010. And without a formal incubation, what happened was that I had moved here to Columbia County in 2004 with my family. And someone knew somehow that I had these musical abilities, and I received a call one day from the pastor of the church up the street, which I had never visited. I really knew very little about it. And their elderly organist had slipped on the ice, and they wondered if, by any chance, I would help them out. And I was covered with mud. I had been working in the garden, and I said, "Listen, I haven't been playing regularly for a number of years, but let me come right over and I'll tell you in 5 minutes." So I grabbed some J.S. Bach off the shelf and played a few of my favorite pieces. And it went very well and really kindled something. And I said, yes. And then I said, well, why don't we have a little choir? So we developed a little choir for the occasion. And it was successful. And someone planted a seed saying, well, you should play an organ recital for us sometime. Well, I seldom say no to anything. And as it turned out, we did a combination organ recital. And I put together a choir. I called my very good friend Amanda Boyd, who is an excellent soprano, lives right here in Columbia County, had been a student of Janet Baker in England, as a matter of fact. I said, Amanda, why don't you come do something on this organ recital? Let's make it a little more interesting than the average organ recital. And it developed into a concert. And 175 people showed up, to my surprise and satisfaction. And I woke up the next morning and said, what are we going to do next?
What did you play on the first occasion?
Oh, what did I play? Well, I played the César Franck A minor chorale. He wrote three important chorales for organ. I say chorales, that's what he calls them, but they're more like 15, 20-minute concert pieces. And I played the great Bach G major fantasy, early work of Bach, in three movements. It had been perhaps my all-time favorite organ work forever. It's rather an impressive piece, and it works well. It's never failed me. I played also, because of the Dutch heritage around here, works of Jan Pieterszoon Sweelinck, early 17th, late 16th century composer. I played two chorale preludes of Bach, and I probably played some Brahms. But then, with Amanda, and a chorus of what I call them the original 18. 18 singers I was just knocked on doors, and so to speak, and I wound up with 18 singers, a few of whom are still with me. Some people have, shall we say, self-edited out, but we had a very exciting little group, and they did very well. I chose a piece by Mendelssohn. It's called Hear My Prayer. Part of it is a famous aria called Oh for the Wings of a Dove. And this piece was ideal because It was for soprano, which was, that was Amanda, for organ, me, conducting from the organ, and choir, and the choir parts are very accessible, not too difficult. And that went very well. And then Amanda and I did the Et Incarnatus Est from the Mozart C minor Mass. And we also had a premiere of a piece by a Columbia County composer, a little Magnificat by Robert Baxa, still living here in Columbia County, and a very, very prolific American composer.
So you have a very Catholic taste, as it were.
I do. That's fair to say. And sometimes people may think that I focus a little bit more on the 18th century, and that's probably true in part for practical reasons, because Handel is so accessible. But then as things develop, we really have gotten into the 19th century as well, and we're going to be doing more of that with Brahms, Mendelssohn, and Beethoven. For example, 3 or 4 years ago, and I never would have dreamed this in 2010, but I will say in 2000, I think it was 2013 or 14, we did the great Beethoven Mass in C major. And I discovered that the 40 singers I regularly have, drawn from a pool of about 55, can acquit themselves very well in the 19th century. And last year, at the school, we did the 1921 original version of Arthur Honegger's King David. And that's a 20th century piece, obviously. And it went extremely well. So I'm not satisfied just settling into one period. I'm very sensitive to performance practice in all periods. What's appropriate in style, playing and singing, but probably getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. But so this grew out of this original concert, organ recital / concert, and the reception was so gratifying. I was actually rather startled, and then I had so much encouragement in the community to do additional concerts, and now actually we are about to do our 20th concert.
Your 20th concert?
20th concert, yes.
How do you rehearse for these concerts?
Well, there are many components. My concerts have a way of being that way. We have the chorus, which is the original ensemble. In fact, it didn't even have a name. The names existed on my computer. So, I used to call them the database chorale, could be the Excel spreadsheet chorale. However, after a while, they developed such integrity musically that even they knew they needed a name. So, a number of them came up to me and said, "We need a name." Well, I already had a name that I was using for a group of chamber players. So, the Broad Street Chamber Players gave a name to the Broad Street Chorale. And then eventually, as I begin to use professional instrumentalists, and all of the instrumentalists are professional, so we call the orchestra the Broad Street Orchestra. So what happened was, if you can imagine, we have the umbrella, which we'll call Concerts in the Village. And we are both a performing and a presenting organization. We're a self-presenting organization. And then there's a third component called the Broad Street Chamber Players. That could be piano four hands, it could be a string quartet or whatever. So typically, as far as how we present, how we prepare for a concert, the chorale usually begins first in preparation, although it amazes some people how quickly we are able to prepare the chorale. Rehearsals actually happen in my living room. You might say my formal living room, where we're sitting today. I can accommodate 50. So for most of our choral preparation purposes, except when we want to be in the performing acoustic, we meet here, normally on Saturday morning. In fact, one of my best marketing devices, as it were, is that if people see cars on the corner of Eichebusch and Broad Street, and it's a Saturday morning, they always say, well, there must be a concert coming up. So it's, I hadn't designed it that for marketing purposes, but that's the way it turned out.
Are the singers mostly from Kinderhook?
No. In fact, the singers are mostly not from Kinderhook. But I can tell you that the philosophy of Concerts in the Village, as it has evolved, and it's very much my philosophy, is that we want to be, you might say, a kind of musical locavore. Just as we all so enjoy what's coming out of the ground right here in Columbia County. The same is true for our musical resources. So virtually all of my singers come from Columbia County, but they come from all over Columbia County. East Chatham, Hudson, some from Kinderhook, but this is not a neighborhood venture. And I can tell you also that that breadth of involvement, that geographic breadth of involvement of the performers is very helpful because everyone has a cousin, everyone has a neighbor, et cetera, et cetera. And especially in our early years, that was very important to audience development. Because one thing that is distinguishing our efforts is that our audience, and they've been very loyal, typical audience is between 200 and 300 people, which is very good around here. But people take great satisfaction coming to a concert, looking up and seeing a relative, a neighbor, a coworker, whatever. There is a sense of connection that is very important to our development, to the development of any such organization. So for example, I can go to Carnegie Hall and hear one of the great orchestras of the world. They all come through Carnegie Hall, and I'll have a very satisfying musical experience. But I won't know anyone, and when they leave the stage, they're gone. It was almost like turning on your TV and seeing a concert of it is a degree of removal. You can't be removed when you come to one of our concerts because you're bound to know someone who's there. And the same would be true for like the Ghent Playhouse. You go and you see a friend of yours, or your friend says, why not come? And afterwards you're talking about it with that person. So there's a connectedness that however great the performance may be, is not there when you go to a major hall.
And as far as your audience is concerned,
Kinderhook might be 10% of our audience. This area that we draw from, an area that would be Albany, Lenox, down Hillsdale, northern Dutchess, Catskill, in fact, Great Barrington. We get quite a few people from Great Barrington.
How did you end up in Kinderhook?
As a matter of fact, my wife and I were contemplating moving out of the New York suburban area. I worked in Manhattan. She had worked in Manhattan. I grew up in Troy. I studied with the head of music, I might add, for 50 years. I didn't study for 50 years, but he was there for 50 years, at the Emma Willard School, and I lived about five blocks from Emma Willard. And he had a fabulous music program. And I became one of his private students. His name was Russell Locke. And then I, having lived all my life to that point in Troy, I went off to Harvard. And there I studied English, as a matter of fact, a sort of classic liberal arts, broadly educated person. I don't know that they exist anymore. But I continued to do a great deal of music. And I became the head accompanist for the choral groups at Harvard, which actually is a little bit more than you might imagine. It had been a distinguished list of accompanists. Leonard Bernstein, for example, I may say, was for a while my predecessor, as it were. And I was multiply involved on tour throughout the country, and I derived great satisfaction from that. And then in 1969, as I was graduating, Vietnam seemed like a less appetizing option than anything I'd been doing. But the reality was, of course, that many people were going off to Vietnam. But as an alternative, I chose to stay at Harvard and do a graduate degree, not in English, but in musicology. And I continued conducting. I conducted the Harvard Radcliffe Chorus and spent some time in Europe in 1967, actually, when I was an undergraduate. And then spent time with Nadia Boulanger, probably the most famous pedagogue of the 20th century. That was extremely important. And that, as much as anything, cemented my commitment. Then I decided also to I was a bit of an academic holic or whatever, and I chose to do a graduate degree at Yale in music theory, studying with a very famous theorist by the name of Alan Fort, although I continued performing as well at Yale.
And music theory, remind us all what that is exactly.
Music theory. Okay, musicology, for the most part, focuses on the history of music. But it's a multiply involved discipline. Certainly, you have to have some performing experience. But people come at it from different angles. Sometimes they're linguists, and but music theory, on the other hand, is a primary analysis of music, taking pieces apart, putting them back together, understand exactly how they work, what was likely the process for any given composer. That's the analytical side. On a somewhat more practical side is harmony, which you grossly simplify, you could say is the vertical aspect of music. Counterpoint, which, again, very simplified, is the horizontal side of music, and specifically very obscure stuff, but also writing fugues, model composition is another thing. I learned a great deal in every respect by doing something that isn't done so much now, but it's called model composition. So when I was at Harvard, I studied with a number of well-known composers, David Del Tredici, contemporary composer, Earl Kim, and we would have assignments to create works in the manner, but in a very specific manner, of, for example, Debussy Prelude, or Bach Fugue, or Haydn Slow Movement from a piano sonata. And if you can actually create a work of music that is convincingly imitative of an important composer, you learn a great deal in the process. So I did a lot of that. So theory studies at Yale were very, very satisfying for one thing. My mentor there was probably one of the most important American theorists of the late 20th century, Alan Fort. And he was also a Schenkerian, which is a little complicated to describe in an interview, but it's not unlike what linguists do when they take, how can I put this? When they take phrase, there's a large phrase, and then within it there's kind of a middle ground, and then you get into a very detailed foreground. And it's reductive.
And how do you spell that?
Schenker. Heinrich Schenker. S-C-H-E-N-C-K-E-R. I don't know whether he's ever been mentioned on the radio in America before, but in any event, that was actually fairly new to me, but I believe strongly in it. It's a fairly complex kind of analysis, but you, again, learn a lot about many works. So that's what music theory is. Sometimes it becomes very abstract, and sometimes it's quite something, you know, it could be explained to anyone. But all, throughout all of this, I was performing, mostly conducting, but quite a bit of keyboard work as well, to my satisfaction. And also, while I was at Yale, I spent one summer at the Aspen Music School. Again, this was a very important influence for me because I had my first opportunity at large-scale orchestral conducting. And I really do both, which in the music world, most people want to pigeonhole other people. Orchestral conductors will say, well, he's a choral conductor. Choral conductors will say, well, he's an orchestral conductor. And I refuse to be pigeonholed. And I truly believe that if you're broadly educated in music with strong, I think, innate skills, you can operate in both worlds. And you should operate in both worlds. So I'll give you one example. When we did the Beethoven Mass in C, In 2014, the first part of the program was the great concert aria, Perfido of Beethoven, and the Schubert Fifth Symphony. That's my idea of a program. So I don't do choral programs. I don't do, well, occasionally I do an orchestral program. I could do a choral program. I have in my life. But I love programs that make, that have a another story to them. And I can tell you many people find this interesting because they find the textures so varied.
Now, in the concert that's coming up at the school,
yes.
What are you going to be?
Good. It's a good example. Well, when I program, there's usually some germ, that something that where it all begins. And in this case, because last year we had done the Honegger King David, very successfully, in every respect, both artistically successful and it was an audience success. That early version only has one string player, string bass, and then it has 12 wind players, 3 keyboards, and 3 percussionists. So there are no upper strings, but I have fabulous upper string players in the Broad Street Orchestra. So I thought this year, especially given the very resonant acoustic, that I would focus on the string sections of the Broad Street Orchestra. And they found that very appealing, I can promise you. So there isn't a better piece to begin with, if that's your essential assumption, than the Vaughan Williams Fantasia on a theme by Thomas Tallis, which is arguably, along with the Tchaikovsky Serenade, probably the most famous string piece ever. Following that, because I have such a wonderful relationship with the soprano Amanda Boyd, whom I mentioned earlier, and who lives within 5 miles of my house, we are going to do a very important song cycle by Benjamin Britten, called Les Illuminations. The texts are by Rimbaud, whose poetry is not always easy to grasp, but there's something very special there. Well, Britten in 1939, happened to live in Amityville, Long Island. I know we think that he's as English as could be, and he is, and he even was then, but he was, I guess you'd say, a conscientious objector during World War II. And spent some time in this country. I guess, I don't know how that all worked, but it worked. And while he was here, he wrote this cycle. And it's for strings. I should say, very complicated string texture. Not aggressively modern, I should say, as Britten is seldom aggressively modern. But the textures in the string writing, just extraordinary. And beautiful vocal writing. It all comes together with marches and slightly folk-like moments. It's really an incredible. So I thought this would be perfect. It's a big piece. It's 25 minutes long. And that will conclude the first part of the concert. So again, we have a lot of textual variety in that. And I should add that the Vaughan Williams, with which we open, will have 20 string players, which is a substantial string orchestra. And it's not just one orchestra, it's actually two orchestras. So it's Orchestra 1, Orchestra 2, and a string quartet. And I'm very excited about this because it's a piece I've known forever. Not only that, but Vaughan Williams wrote the Great Fantasia for Gloucester Cathedral in the west of England. So the acoustic that we have at the school, which is not probably successful for all kinds of music, will be perfect for that. And I'm very confident perfect for the Britain as well. And then I thought, oh, now what else do we do? I said, well, we have an intermission. And then I like doing pieces by well-known composers, that the pieces which are not so well-known. I dare say that 90% of the time for a famous composer, we're hearing 10% of his output. But what about the other 90%? Well, I found a piece by Saint-Saëns from 1900, opus 114, called La Nuit, the Night. And it is the most lushly textured piece you could imagine. It's for strings, harp, soprano solo, flute obbligato, and women's chorus. So we're using the women of the Broad Street Chorale. It's about 13 or 14 minutes long. And it could not be more interesting. It's in three sections. In the middle section is a wonderful dialogue between a soprano solo and the flute it as a nightingale. And much give and take. Occasionally moments that are highly chromatic, almost in a Wagnerian way. But beautifully written, you know, Saint-Saëns was a very facile composer. It's the sort of thing he probably did before noon one day. Beautifully orchestrated, and I'm just delighted to be doing that. And then I'm doing a piece that I last did 50 years ago. I know that must be some, those who know me must say, how is it possible that he did this piece 50 years ago? I'm doing a Poulenc's Litany à la Vierge Noire, and this piece has an interesting history. In 1939, I have to correct myself, in 1936, Poulenc lost a good friend, and he had not been especially spiritual, Poulenc, but as a child he'd been an observant Catholic, as everyone else was in France, nearly everyone else. And he felt moved upon the death of this friend to go to Rocamadour, where there's a famous statue in black marble, the Black Virgin of Rocamadour. And I guess he sat there, and he hadn't written any sacred music, any liturgical music, none. He was successful by then, but he had not written any sacred music. And he was so moved that he wrote this 10-minute work of the litanies in 1936 for young voices, or we'll say women's voices, and organ. And it was 50 years ago that I didn't have the pleasure of conducting the work, but I was the organist for the work in a performance at Harvard. And I never forgot it. Well, in 1947, 11 years after writing the original version, for whatever reason, maybe he thought there were additional royalties available, he decided to publish a second version of the piece for strings and women's voices. The women's voices, that writing did not change. But obviously the texture changed. But it takes on a life of its own, and it's incredible music, because it's very much like looking at the Middle Ages or early Renaissance, as he was in Rocamadour. So you hear these chant-like passages, and then all of a sudden it's through a 20th century lens, and chromaticism creeps in. And then at the end of this chromatic, very kind of elaborate tonality, and then all of a sudden it breaks out and it concludes very simply and very tonally. It was simple chords. It's not a long piece, but it is a very, very effective piece. So having, you know, with the Saint-Saëns, having the women available, having the strings available, having that space at the school, which is so resonant, I thought, perfect. And, you know, the Bowen Williams couldn't be more English. Britain is English, but it's a French text. Intermission. Then we have a French text and a French composer. So there's a certain symmetry there. And then we have another French piece. And then to conclude, I thought, well, how to finish? Arthur Foote was one of a group of composers sometimes called the New England Six, or the Boston Six, a late 19th, early 20th century composers. In fact, he had taught at Harvard, which is not when I was there, but he had taught at Harvard. And Foote was a very fine composer, trained largely in Europe. And he wrote, I think, on the commission of the Boston Symphony, probably before Koussevitzky, but maybe not, a work called the Suite for String Orchestra, E major, Opus 63. It was done quite a few times by the Boston Symphony. It still crops up on programs, not as often as it really should. And it's in three movements, concludes with a very vigorous fugue, very contrapuntal conclusion, but incredibly spirited. So we have high spirits at the end. The Poulenc is what I call a very mystical spirit. That's the Saint-Saëns is mysterious, not so mystical as mysterious. So we're shifting in the course of our afternoon through all of this. So there's a lot of variety, even though the resources, the strings, are at the core of it. So we'll begin in England with strings. We conclude in America.
And if people want to go to the concert,
how to do this? Well, I can tell you from our past experience that our concerts at the school have been very popular. Seating is limited to about 250, maybe to 260. It's on the lower area. Perhaps many of your listeners have been there. The school was a school. Perhaps you covered that in other interviews. And it's 30,000 square feet of the most amazing adaptive reuse that I could imagine. And Jack Shaman, who is responsible for all of this, has done the community a huge favor. I think there's nothing like it in probably 50, 60 miles, perhaps up at Mass Moca. It's quite, in a village of 1,200, to imagine that we would have that. But the school, the building just happened to be available. And he happened to be looking for 30,000 square feet in New York City, as I understand the story. And happened to be driving down Broad Street, which is, I have to say, it's two blocks from my house. I can't complain. I have three wonderful and wonderfully different places for concerts in the village to perform within three blocks of my house. I mean, how could I ask for more? But this is developed, you know, organically. So we'll be at the school on the lower level, which is hard to believe, formerly the gymnasium, but you wouldn't recognize it as that at all. Ideal for this program, Concerts in the Village has a website, and because of the past experience at the school and the seating limited to 250 or 260, we actually do take reservations on the website, www.concertsinthevillage.org. If you just simply search for Concerts in the Village and Kinderhook, it'll come up right away. You don't have to pay on the website, but you can be assured seating as long as you show up within, we'll say, 5 or 10 minutes of concert time, which is 2 o'clock on Sunday the 12th. So I think the website is a good place to go. We might have as many as 50% of the seating already reserved, perhaps more. So 3 years ago, we did a performance of Purcell's great opera, the first opera in English, called Dido and Aeneas. This was a concert performance. Arguably, it was originally a concert performance. My good friend Judy Grunberg from PS21 in Chatham happened to be at the performance, enjoyed it very much, and then said in her inimitable creative way, "Oh, let's do a semi-staged performance at PS21 this summer." And that caught my fancy, and we did. It was more fun than you can imagine. We had a director from New York, and even the Broad Street Chorale, not used to singing, as they say, off book. Off book means without music. Sang off book. And it was a very, very engaging experience. Musically successful. Dramatically, I think it was pretty successful. We did 2 performances, actually, on a Saturday evening and the next day in the afternoon. So that's another venue that we very much enjoyed. So we took ourselves all the way from Kinderhook to Chatham. We took the show on the road, as it were. Then the following year, as a matter of fact, we were invited to do the Paul Grunberg Memorial Bach Concert, which is a very important event at PS181 each year in memory of Judy's husband. And we did 2 Bach cantatas, a Bach motet. I played a Bach concerto, and we also did the double concerto for oboe and violin of Bach. And that was a big success. And that brought together sort of a seminal moment, I think. All of the forces, Broad Street Orchestra, Broad Street Chorale, and guest soloist. And again, probably 90 to 95% of the people who perform, whether they're instrumental or vocal, are within 40 to 45 miles of here, predominantly within 20 miles of here. And I continue to be amazed at how much talent there is. I'm constantly discovering that so-and-so lives over in down in Ankrum or whatever, and I never knew it, but it all comes together. The other thing is, when I began this, it was a significant effort. You're knocking on doors to get people's attention, whether they're supporters, listeners, or performers. And in the process, there can be disappointments, but I can promise you there have been many more good moments than disappointing moments. And now I am getting, as it were, solicited by people of significant talents who want to come and be with us. I have a real bias, as much as possible, drawing upon people from our region. And that serves me well, because the audience realizes that, and I think it's kind of like rooting for the home team.
Now, that's true of instrumentalists as well, you're able to find in the area.
Very seldom do I have to go beyond the region. Now, I define the region, especially in terms of our instrumental resources, as being essentially Schenectady, Albany County, Columbia County, Southern Rensselaer, my wonderful concertmaster, Elizabeth Silver, lives in Naval Park. And she is, in effect, I guess, the assistant concertmaster in the Albany Symphony. I have the principal oboe player, regularly, from the Albany Symphony. We have significant talents. And the first time I brought in professional instrumentalists, I thought, well, I wonder how this will go, because we were mixing non-professionals and professionals. It went swimmingly. For one thing, if you're a non-professional, and that's not to say not experienced, it just means you're not being paid for what you do, you really rise to the occasion when you're playing with those you perceive to be doing this all the time. You know, it brings out the best in the non-professionals. And as a matter of fact, I now also refer to concerts in the village, the orchestra, the chorus, the soloists, as an academy. So I can decide now what I want to do, and then I'll say, okay, I've got Liz to do this, I've got Karen to do that, the chorus would be fine with this, I have probably 15 or 20 soloists now, vocal soloists on my roster, and I know who's particularly good with 19th century music, or Purcell much earlier, or Bach, or whatever. And one other thing I should add is that, specifically in the vocal area, Bard has been very important. You know, Bard is a major regional influence in music. And fairly early on, I developed a relationship with the graduate vocal arts program at Bard, headed by Dawn Upshaw. And I think I've given significant professional opportunity to about 10 of her graduate students, some of whom have gone on to significant careers, and then they don't forget who treated them nicely early on. And I promise you, if I call, they're delighted to come back. On my bucket list, I always say the number of pieces I would like to do is probably greater in length than the years that I have. But I'm working on it. And it'll probably keep my years longer. In any event, one of the pieces is the great Haydn creation. And that's a possibility for this coming fall. And I already have a pretty good idea who the soloists will be. And they will be delighted. And I've worked with them before. They're wonderful to work with. And all the instrumentalists have been wonderful. Because what happened was that we started with 5 string players and an oboe player and a bassoonist. And now I have as many as 28 or 30 in the orchestra. And I was told with the first performance with professional instrumentalists, I was told by almost every one of them, you just let me know when you're doing something, and if I'm available, I will be happy to come back to Kinderhook. And the other thing they have noticed is how responsive the chorale has been to their level of playing. It just brings everybody up. And there's nothing more gratifying than having a great, great concert. As we will on the 12th, I'm confident of that. But now we're doing 4 to 6 concerts every year. That may be slightly expanded next year with some chamber concerts as well, taking advantage of what we call the Broad Street Chamber Players. We have a third venue right here in Kinderhook, which was introduced in October this past fall. For about 4 years, I had been doing some experimenting privately with the second floor of the Kinderhook Village Hall. It's an 1874 structure. And the second, and in effect the third floor, high ceilings, was a community space in the late 19th century, a real gathering place. And it so happens that with the materials, especially the materials of that time, plaster lath, hardwood floors, no acoustical tile, actually a tin ceiling, turns out The acoustics are a dream. A dream both for the performers, who can hear one another easily. Every player this past fall, we concluded with the Haydn Symphony. It was just fantastic. And every player was totally satisfied. The audience could not believe the sound that they were hearing. It was just so professional and so beautifully delivered in that acoustic. So I'll be doing more there. And I'm hoping that other institutions in the region will notice it and will bring some of their concert making to Kinderhook, where I can guarantee them great acoustic. So here we are with three venues here, hopefully some future visits to PS21, that's strictly a summertime, at this point, a summertime option, and reception couldn't be better. The Village Hall space in Kinderhook, which seats 172, church seats 475, the school seats 250, so I have a lot of variety. I have acoustical variety, I have design variety, certainly, 1874 Village Hall, Jack's amazing, as it were, white canvas, and then the church, which is essentially about 1875, but it's all wood and, you know, beautiful walnut. And the acoustics are all different. The Opera House, I am very, very curious about. My only experience there has been in the room on the first floor, which they've been using for concerts. Its capacity is somewhat limited. The second floor, it will be interesting. I did attend the opera Diamond Street, which was, I think, about 4 or 5 years ago. And by exception, apparently, they got permission to have occupancy up there, and the performance took place. And I recall the acoustics as being pretty good, but I have to, but the instrumentalists weren't playing from the stage, so I couldn't really get an idea what it was like. But I'm certainly curious, more than curious, and maybe something will happen. I'm grateful for Kinderhook in the sense that as I look at the region, it is a sort of a midpoint between Albany, Great Barrington, Lenox, and we'll say Catskill. So that's good. It's well situated. Parking is not an issue. People know where we are. And I think that's very important for an institution. We've worked hard on this. It's developed. For an institution to be associated with a specific physical space. Boston Symphony, Symphony Hall, Tanglewood. If you say Tanglewood, it only means one thing. If you say Symphony Hall, I was at Symphony Hall. Immediately, people know, oh, BSL. And that was certainly true for the New York Philharmonic when they were at Carnegie. Although now, if you say New York Philharmonic, it's Lincoln Center. They're about to do a major renovation there, which will have them being somewhat gypsy-like around New York City, but they'll have to figure that out. So the fact that people associate us with these specific venues, first the church, then the school, then the Village Hall, and occasionally, in a summer sense, with PS21. They know where we are. I can also tell you that one of the most common remarks to me is, I went to the concert and I couldn't believe this was happening in Kinderhook. Now, that's not a slight of Kinderhook, but I dare say there are very few villages of 1,200 people in New York State and beyond that have something so vibrant and, very importantly, something which is organic to the region. I could have said, oh, Kinderhook needs music, or the area needs music. Why don't I just raise money and call Boston and New York and say, send talent. That's easy. I mean, it's not difficult. It's maybe difficult to raise money, but I can promise you the call to New York is easy. And they'll be knocking on your door forever. But we did something quite different. And it's this organic experience that's been so special. And very special for me personally, but not just me. There are people singing in the chorale, for example, who sang maybe 35 years ago in college. They did a European tour with their college group, and then it just, life got busy, and now they've returned to it. Because I spent, as it were, maybe, let me see, about 30 years in the non-musical wilderness. Now, it makes some of this possible. And I will say, because of what I do, we don't have any, I can't turn to the senior vice president for marketing and say, did you call the Times Union? Did you? No, I am the senior vice president. I'm all of those things. Although I can also tell you that at this point in time, and really from the start, I could not have done this without my wife. This has become, as it were, the family business. We give of our time, but it's kind of the family business, as you can see looking around my former living room. But there have been a number of other people who've been extremely gracious. I mentioned earlier Liz Silver from Able Park, extremely fine violinist. And she has put me in touch with so many professional musicians in the area. And now I have a database of about a pool of talent, as it were, about 60. So depending on what I'm doing, what the specific instrumental needs are, I send out the call, and if they're available, they'll be here. Nothing could be more satisfying. So I guess I'd come back from the wilderness and couldn't be more gratifying. I feel like I should be paying for the experience.
I'm sure Kinderhook is grateful.
They are. I mean, the village, the second floor of the village hall has had some significant restoration, which they wanted to do for a long time. I'm not saying they did it for me, but what I've been doing here in Kinderhook and the success in creating an artistic destination. I mean, we could not simply do this drawing upon the people, the 1,200 people in the village of Kinderhook. We have many, many, many loyal listeners from Kinderhook, but we couldn't develop an audience as large as what we need to make it happen without doing that. So, but the village really has gotten behind this, and the restoration of the second floor, which isn't complete yet, but is significantly complete, was largely done, I think, because they saw that people will come to Kinderhook if there's a good artistic reason to do so. Just as people come from a great distance, even Europe, as a matter of fact, to visit the school because of the importance of what Jack offers there. So I think we've created a model with Concerts in the Village. I think it's actually worth a study because I think it could be replicated elsewhere. Not easily, because there are areas that are deserving of what we do, but they may simply not have the pool of talent that we have here. I didn't move here for this, but it's like moving somewhere and discovering there's oil in the ground. It's very satisfying. I appreciate this very much.
Thank you very much, David, for doing this.